Hello and welcome to Sip for Speech, the podcast for professionals in public finance. Apologies for this month's episode coming to you a little later than usual. We here at Sip for, along with the rest of the world, have been working hard to adapt around COVID-19, but we're keen to keep bringing you top-notch, interesting content even in troubled times. On this month's episode, you'll be hearing from David Phillips from the Institute for Fiscal Studies and Joanne Pitt on council tax reform, and Ian Ratcliffe from NHS England and NHS Improvement on IFRS 16. But first, a word from Sip for CEO Rob Whiteman, reflecting on the ongoing situation with coronavirus and what it may mean for public services in the future.
Hi, it's Rob Whiteman here. I hope you're well. I don't need to stress the strangeness of the times in which we live, and we're all now getting used to suddenly working virtually. Just a couple of thoughts from me standing back from this. I think there are probably three phases of what we're going through, aren't we? There's an emergency phase, then there is going to be some form of business as usual, and then there's going to be a new order that emerges from this, and things that become accelerated that wouldn't have happened otherwise. Everybody I talk to, it's quite incredible how quickly organisations have adapted. Public services are doing an incredible job. I guess under this first phase, the emergency, there are just a ton of issues to deal with. I know, for example, talking to colleagues in the NHS, the biggest single problem they face today is the inability to test. There are people stuck at home who needn't be, and so the urgent need for testing within the NHS is considerable. In a few days, there'll be another issue that really needs dealing with, and every organisation is going to just have a long list of things that come and go as emergency crises that have to be handled. Here at SIPFA, we had about 120 events, training sessions and events planned for March, April and May. Nearly all of those have already been moved to a virtual environment. How long will this emergency phase last? I guess my personal reflection on it is that we maybe need a bit of luck. I think when we get to the other end, it's hard to imagine the degree of interconnectedness and globalisation not being questioned. What do we do about that when we're the other side of this problem, that we want economic growth, but actually we don't want to go back to what we've been doing? Will the world order change on that, or do we revert to where we were? I think this is such a significant event that there'll be new questions asked. Let's remember that the profession in the public sector is playing an important role. Our profession is absolutely vital to make sure that we get through these difficult times and that organisations can sustain, and more importantly, the services that they provide. So I don't know how long this emergency phase will last. Is it 3 months? Is it a year? The other side of it, there will probably be some new questions asked. I think that will only be possible by considerable public spending to the degree that we haven't seen before. For local authorities, to think of them for a second, probably income will be very challenged, council tax, business rates. Whilst expenditure is going up, in order to make sure that what needs to be done has to be done. As accountants, we borrow for capital, not to provide services. But actually, in that recovery phase of public services, we'll probably have to change some of the rules on that. And people may have to borrow, organisations may have to borrow in order to sustain services. And the government is going to have to put a lot more money into public services. Local government needs that too. And I think local government will just rise to the challenge and get on and do the job and do what's needed. SIPFA's doing its best to try and share good practice and help with problems on a daily basis. We're absolutely determined to make sure that we now operate digitally and virtually in the absence of meetings and events. And if you've got any ideas on what you want us to do, please let me know. Take care.
You're listening to Sip for Speaks, and that was Rob Whiteman speaking about the coronavirus. Up next, we have Ian Ratcliffe, the Assistant Director of Sector Financial Accounting from NHS England/Improvement on IFRS 16. Now, at the time of this segment's recording, coronavirus had not yet spread to the global pandemic level of crisis that we're facing today. As a result of the government's recent nationwide lockdown measures and the unprecedented levels of stress on the NHS and other public services, the decision was taken to delay IFRS 16 for a year in light of the ongoing pressures. Although the implementation of IFRS 16 will be delayed until 2021-22, the discussion we had with Ian continues to be highly relevant for public finance professionals as and when IFRS 16 comes to be implemented. So, over to Ian and my colleague Callahan Hager, who joined him for the interview.
Thank you for tuning in today. I'm here with Ian Ratcliffe, an Assistant Director of Sector Financial Accounting at NHS England and NHS Improvement, to talk about leadership for accountants in the NHS. Thank you for joining us, Ian.
Hi, Cal. Good to see you.
Thanks for being here today. To kick things off, can you give us an overview of your current role and your background as a CIPFA accountant?
Yes, I joined CIPFA as a student 15 years ago, and my career at that time was in an accounting and audit firm where I specialised in audit in local government and the NHS. My current role is at NHS England and NHS Improvement, which includes a team looking after reporting from the ledger for commissioners, that integrated ledger, and a team primarily focused on statutory accounting and reporting for providers in the NHS, including the consolidated provider accounts that are laid before Parliament.
Sounds very impressive.
Well, the numbers are big, at least.
Can you give us a little bit more of a broader idea of the work of NHS England and NHS Improvement?
Yeah. NHS England and NHS Improvement came together in April 2019. We're not fully there yet, but that's when it formally kicked off, to better support how the NHS increasingly works. We are organised around seven integrated regional teams who play a leadership role in the geographies that they manage. They support and assure performance in the region of those organisations and support system transformation and development. For the past couple of decades or so, depending on how you measure it, the model in the NHS has been a separation between provider organisations, so hospitals and ambulances and other organisations that provide secondary care, and commissioner organisations. When we talk of systems, a word you'll hear us talk and say a lot, it's about breaking down those barriers. It's actually really hard for a provider to be successful without a healthy commissioning environment, and vice versa. The system also brings in community and local government funded services. So the coming together of NHS England and NHS Improvement is designed to reflect those local changes and better support the NHS. My team is part of Financial Control, which is in one of the national directorates for finance and performance.
And you're also a FRAB member as well, right?
Yes, FRAB is the Financial Reporting Advisory Board, and its primary role is to ensure that government financial reporting meets the best possible standards of reporting. The Government Resources and Accounts Act set out that Treasury should consult on a group of appropriate people to advise on financial reporting, and that role is fulfilled by FRAB. FRAB includes representatives from the accountancy profession, regulators, academia, and government bodies. CIPFA, of course, is present as a relevant authority. I've been a FRAB member for a couple of years, and it's an important and quite interesting responsibility. The five-hour meetings can be a bit intense. They include some really bright people from across the profession, and there's some real rigorous intellectual challenge and debate, but at the same time it's also friendly and good-natured, and even in the time that I've been there, has made some decisions and given advice on some really important areas that will affect public sector accounting and reporting for years to come in NHS, local government and wider government.
So what are some of the biggest issues that you've been working on in your current role?
Well, there's lots going on. In financial control in NHS England and NHS Improvement, we need to implement an integrated management accounts platform, which sounds dull on the face of it, but actually is so important, as probably people listening to this podcast will know, because it's how you run an organisation. So that covers our organisations coming together, but also that are actually independent statutory entities, and we need to be able to report in that way. Needs to cover the billions of pounds spent directly by NHS England, as well as the commissioning environment more widely. We're also working hard on how we can improve the efficiency of transacting in the NHS. So some of the data that we have in the integrated ledger environment shows, for example, that in 2017-18, of all the invoices that flow between providers and commissioners, 79% of the invoices by number covered less than 1% of the volume of transactions numerically. So there's a lot of small invoices that go on around the system. We've got plans to try and improve that. Every invoice has a cost, has to be processed at both sides. Can we free up, take some of that transacting cost out of the system? We're also working on testing how robotic automation can work in financial accounts and reporting, looking, for example, at how robotics can assist with control account reconciliations to make some of the work that we do more efficient, That's being tested to potentially then look at how it could be rolled out across the group. Plus, we've got all the standard financial reporting for the NHS, which is vitally important, obviously, but goes on. And then on top of all of that, the thing that is exercising my team quite a lot at the moment is IFRS 16, the new lease accounting standard, which seems to be all-consuming.
Yeah, can you give us a quick overview of IFRS 16?
Well, as everyone should know, the folklore tale, which I think is true, is that back in 2008, the chairman of the International Accounting Standards Board said at a conference that before he dies, he wants to fly on an aircraft that's on the balance sheet of the airline. So it's a big change in leasing, and so his wish is now coming true. So for a long time, in both old UK GAAP and IFRS, we've had that distinction between operating and finance leases. So when you lease something as a lessee, it affects whether the asset that it's related to is on your balance sheet or not. The view of the IASB is, well, if you're an investor, that distinction is artificial because for the period of the lease, you've got the use of the asset. So the big headline from the new standard is that for lessees, all leases come on balance sheet. You no longer have that operating and finance lease distinction, which has some huge implications. It's technically complex and changes accounts. It's a huge global thing affecting industries around the world and also obviously affects us in the public sector.
What are some examples of some of the leases that the NHS uses? Some practical examples.
So as part of reforms a few years ago, the government accounts and the overall accounts are what you see is the leases with the external bodies that make it into the accounts. In the NHS, we also have a lot of what we call intergroup trading. So there's a body within the Department of Health, NHS Property Services, that his primary responsibility is to look after the estate used by lots of NHS organisations. So there's lots of leases inside the NHS group. So NHS providers and commissioners have leases with property services for lots of the buildings they use to deliver services to patients. Plus, of course, people lease medical equipment, scanners, MRI, diagnostic equipment. There's a lot of leases for that. So there's a lot of leases in the NHS, as there is in local government.
And it's integral to providing a good service as
yes,
well.
Yes, absolutely.
So how's the IFRS 16 implementation process been so far?
Well,
apart from all-consuming.
Well, it does seem to be. All-consuming for a standard we haven't actually applied yet. So the standard applies from 1st of April 2020, so for the 2021 financial year. But because of the scale of the task, we've done a lot of work early on that. It's technically complex. So there's lots of small bits of detail that crop up in the NHS and local government on particular issues that have a real impact. So, for example, we just talked about the property services arrangements. Because that's a commercial arrangement brought intra-group, because of the complexity and sheer scale of it, there's lots of examples of where leases that used to be held by previous bodies rolled over to property services, and property services and the tenant, in inverted commas, hasn't formally agreed a documented lease contract yet. But you know, there's an intra-group established arrangement for that sort of thing. The IASB, the International Standards Board, doesn't really foresee examples of where you've got leases that aren't properly commercially documented. So that has big implications. So it means, for example, that if you're an NHS provider or commissioner, you might need to estimate the lease term. Sounds boring, but actually the way in which you estimate the lease term massively affects the way you calculate the lease liability, which also affects how the asset comes onto the balance sheet. So there's just one technical thing that's a really important judgment that bodies are having to look at, auditors are having to look at, so we're helping bodies with all that stuff. And there's lots of examples of minutiae technical things that actually have quite a big impact. But what makes IFRS 16 more important is that its impacts go far beyond the technical stuff. So in central government and the NHS, there's a system of revenue and capital limits that apply at departmental level for total limits on spend. Similar controls in different ways exist then at the level of the NHS organisations. So when all these assets come on balance sheet, and when new stuff comes on balance sheet, that means it becomes an item of capital expenditure, which therefore scores against capital budgets. So that has big implications for how you set limits and monitor the oversight of organisations. It also then affects procurement decisions locally. If you are in an NHS body and you're thinking of how to procure that new set of diagnostic scanners you need, you could potentially buy them or you could lease them. While the cash flow of those two options remains different, more or less, the accounting now becomes much the same. So actually, it starts to change how you make procurement decisions. Finance teams across the NHS are needing to talk more broadly to the organisation because it actually might change how decisions are made and how money is spent. So FRAB has been considering some really interesting issues. For example, in local government, FRAB considered how the housing revenue account works and should that be impacted by IFRS 16. So that's something that SIPFA LASAC is currently considering and working on. But in terms of implementation, I think we've got a pretty good plan in the NHS. We published a plan a while ago that so far we seem to be sticking to. So we've needed to collect lots of information from bodies to help understand that future impact on budgets. People need to know their impact for next year because it affects disclosures in this year's accounts. And then we've got a plan that in the summer, people will restate their opening balances formally. And we're also talking to the audit community about some early work that auditors might do in the autumn so that we know where we're going long before we get to the 2021 year end. So I feel like I spent a lot of time talking about IFRS 16, even though we haven't seen any accounts prepared on that basis yet. But I think we're in decent shape for getting accounts on that basis next year.
It seems like it's a lot of technical what maybe drops in the bucket, but the ripples can actually be really huge across the entire NHS.
Yes, it's a standard that was controversial at the time. It has a global impact, which means a lot of the issues are known about. But yes, you find that actually there's some specifics in local government and the NHS that need further work and has really big implications.
Now, you just mentioned auditors a minute ago. So what are some of the current auditor issues that you're dealing with in the NHS?
So the role of local audit, as it's called in NHS and local government, is an increasing hot topic. So in the NHS, trusts, foundation trusts and commissioners appoint their own auditors. The legislation is the same for local government, but there's lots of local authorities opt in to having their auditors appointed centrally. There's a lot going on in this area. You'll be aware of the things that have been in the press in recent months about accounts misreporting in notable private sector entities, which has put the audit market into sharp focus. Over recent years, auditing standards are changing and developing, increasing the work that auditors need to do in some area. And I think those things, and other things actually, have a really important impact on that relationship between an NHS body and its auditor. So if you're a foundation trust that's been appointing your auditor for a long time, you probably perceive that nothing much has changed, but actually quite a lot has changed. So there's those changes in auditing standards. The organisation in the NHS is getting more complicated, as are local authorities. Audit fees have been probably pushed down with competition in recent years. But at the same time, auditors feel, as a profession, I think it's fair to say, under more scrutiny and slightly more risk averse. So you put all those things together and we perceive that the relationship between NHS bodies and their auditors and the audit market is becoming slightly more challenging. So we're talking to the audit firms about that. I think it's a really interesting area. Of course, at the same time, we've got the Redmond Review in local government, which is a really interesting area with a quite wide scope, looking at the role of local authority accounts and audit, and is what's currently there fit for purpose. It's something that we in health will be keeping a close eye on and feeding into because of how integrated the legislation is. Any changes in local government audit might have implications for health. So yes, Redmond Review is something that we'll be taking a close interest in because audit issues in local government and the NHS seems to be increasing in the agenda of things that people want to talk about.
That's it for our time today. Thank you so much for joining us, Ian.
Thank you.
Interesting stuff there, and thank you to Ian for joining us this month. Finally today, we have Joanne Pitt, SIPFA's Local Government Policy Manager, and David Phillips from the Institute for Fiscal Studies to talk council tax reform.
I'm here with David Phillips from the Institute for Fiscal Studies, who joined us back in October, I believe it was, for our first episode.
Yes, I think I was talking about our annual report on local government finance.
Yes, so thank you very much and welcome back, David. I'm also here with Joanne Pitt, the Local Government Policy Manager for SIPFA, which is her debut on the show. Hello, Jo.
Hello.
So we're here today to talk council tax. So not too long ago, SIPFA put out its annual council tax data, projecting the extent to which local authorities would be putting up their council tax. And this month, the Institute for Fiscal Studies are also putting their own report out around council tax reform. Before we get into all of that, could you both talk me through how council tax came to be? Surely it was fit for purpose once.
Well, council tax has always been a bit of a messy compromise between two different tax systems, domestic rates and the poll tax. It's never been a great compromise. It's actually never really been properly fit for purpose. It's got wide tax bands, the regressive tax rates got much less than property values, and the single person discount effectively subsidises single adults to live in bigger houses than they need. While it's never been great, the failure to revalue it for nearly 30 years means it's now far worse. It must be revalued and it should be reformed. Are we really going to be using 1991 values in 2041? 2091? I mean, it's time to grasp the nettle.
So, Joe, what are your thoughts on that? Do you agree that it was never really fit for purpose at all?
I suppose going back to the sort of Adam Smith four principles of taxation, they're about the fairness, the certainty, the efficiency and the convenience. It was so badly wrong in the poll tax that we then moved to council tax. I think it moved towards those principles. But I do totally agree with David in that we're now 30 years on, and it's moved away from some of those principles more than it has others.
But nonetheless, councils are still fairly reliant on it as a stream of revenue. And from SIPFA's data that came out this month, we've seen that large numbers of local authorities, I think there's only 11 that aren't, are putting their council tax up by the maximum amount without having the need to call a referendum. There is one local authority that is attempting to go beyond that. What do you see as the drivers behind that?
Well, essentially, council tax is still an incredibly important income for local authorities. I mean, if you imagined you were looking at a pie chart and the amount of money that is raised by local authorities for expenditure, about 50% of it comes from government grants. So this is in England as a whole. 50% of it comes from government grants. But sort of 30 to 32% of that is raised from council tax. That's a huge amount of income that is generated from raising council tax. But that section is really, really important to local authorities.
And I think if you look at kind of what's been happening over the last decade, because of big cuts to central government funding for councils, council tax has become a more and more important source of revenues. Focusing on just the spending on things other than schools, council tax has gone up from about 40% to well over 50% of the revenues that councils rely on. And of course, many of the things that councils are funding, things like adult social care, children's social care, housing, these are things where the demand and the costs are going up. So with costs and demand going up, you need more money. And with government grant, until very recently, not doing that, councils have been looking to council tax and really pushing those referendum limits. I mean, my own view actually is that it's rather strange to have a sort of referendum requirement on councils for council tax. With central government, the kind of decisions on tax, it is part of the general electoral politics. Why are councils different to that?
Interesting proposition. Joe, thoughts?
I mean, at one stage, there was an amount of money, it was a tax freeze grant actually paid to local authorities to encourage them not to increase their council tax. What we've seen historically with those that accepted that is that now they are struggling with their council tax because their council tax is lower than it would have been had they continued to raise it by sort of 2 or 3%. Mm. Those historic decisions have actually come back to haunt local authorities.
Both SIPFA and the Institute for Fiscal Studies have called for reform, but the question here is kind of what that looks like. So David, your paper on this calls for revaluation in line with present day property values. What impact would that have on revenue for local services compared to council tax as it is now? Does it have a part to play in the levelling up agenda? You talked a bit about redistribution there. Just tell us a bit more about how you see that working.
Well, I think one of the things that actually put politicians off revaluing properties is that many people think doing so would inevitably mean a big tax rise, and therefore they aren't very keen on this. A revaluation is about updating values so that the relative tax bill that different properties face can reflect their relative values now, not 30 years ago. So in our report, we look at a revenue neutral option for valuing and reforming council tax. That means options that neither raise nor cost the government or councils money, which is basically how revaluation was done in Wales in 2005, and it's how business rates are revalued, which incidentally, most people say should happen more frequently, not less frequently, as is the case with council tax.
Mm-hmm.
Revaluing and reforming council tax in this way could make it fairer and could reduce the average bills for low and middle income households, households headed by younger adults, households where someone has a disability. And of course, on a revenue neutral basis, someone would have to pay for this. So average bills would go up for people with high incomes on average and households headed by older adults. But of course, you could combine reforming the system with either tax cuts, or it could be combined with tax increases to raise more money for local services. So under a reform system, those tax increases would fall less heavily on low and middle income households. Revaluing and reforming doesn't, in its own, raise more money for local government. It's about making the system fairer and more up to date. But it can be combined with either tax cuts or tax rises, depending on what the priority is.
Joe, what are your thoughts on this? You've spoken before about how revaluation needs to be seen in the wider context of local government funding as a whole. What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean is the fact that council tax is one portion of the funding that local government receives. So it gives us a good opportunity to look at the wider picture of local government funding. Whilst council tax takes up a certain portion of the income, we have to see whether it's going to be sufficient to fund the services that it provides or is meant to provide. I think something like 17% of all council tax raised goes on adult social care, and that and children's social care is an increasingly expensive area that is required to be funded. So I think that it would be a very good thing to take council tax out of the too difficult to touch box, because it's been in that box a very, very long while. But there has to be a political will, because it's a long-term commitment, this type of change. And it'll be interesting to see whether politicians in Westminster have the courage to take it out of that too difficult to touch box and start to consider it for the long-term review that's necessary.
And I think we have a real opportunity at the moment with that. We're not naive. We know that changing tax systems, creating losers as well as winners, is a difficult proposition for any government. We have a government at the moment that is committed to what it calls levelling up. And what our report shows is that if alongside revaluing and reforming council tax, you adjust the central government funding system to reflect the new council tax regime, that could lead to substantial cuts in tax bills or increases in public spending in the North and Midlands. That could be funded by some reductions or increases in tax bills in the South, or by finding additional money to top up the system if the government wanted to do that. So revaluing and reforming council tax really could be a kind of a big contributor to this sort of levelling up agenda, certainly in terms of public spending, in terms of reducing the tax bills and increasing people's sort of net disposable incomes. And also, it's a government which has got a pretty hefty majority. If you can't do it at a time like this, when can you do it? I sort of despair to some extent if a time like this, when there's a mandate and there's quite a lot of political power, we can't do these changes that everyone has been talking about for years, knowing they need to be done. If not now, when?
Good question. Although you've both talked about the requirement for political will behind this, majority aside, in your report, David, it does reference the fact that there are going to be winners and losers, and that there are some low-income families who may see their bills go up as a result of revaluation. How can they be supported through transition to something like this?
I think the kind of most important thing to kind of recognise with this is that if you were to revalue and reform council tax to make it more up to date, less regressive, there'd be far more low-income, middle-income winners than losers. So we think, our estimate suggests that amongst the poorest fifth of the population, about a quarter would gain more than £200 a year. Their bills would fall by more than £200 a year. About 4% would see their bills go up by more than £200 a year. So about six times as many low-income households winning quite a bit compared to losing quite a bit in this form. Further up, the distribution of the middle-income households seems like a similar situation. More than half gaining more than £200 a year compared to about 8 or 9% losing that amount of money. So this is a reform that can really help more low- and middle-income households than it could hurt. But that doesn't mean there aren't, of course, these low-income households that could lose. And digging down into the figures, what you see is that in London, because house values are so much higher here and they've gone up so much more, even low-income households in London would lose on average from revaluing and reforming council tax. So I think that is one of the issues that needs to be considered. For private sector tenants, evidence very strongly suggests that when tax bills go up, the rent goes down. And then the real issue could be social housing tenants, where the rents aren't set by the market in that way. And I think there the issue could be looking at council tax support. We look at what the effect would be of reintroducing full council tax support. We think that would cost about £400 million a year, and that addresses a lot of the issue for many of the low-income households that would otherwise see their tax bills go up.
So I suppose to a certain extent, let's kind of get down to brass tacks. How much would the revaluation exercise in and of itself cost?
I think one thing that has changed a lot since the early 90s is technology. Back in the early 90s, what they did to devalue properties was send people around physically to observe properties. Nowadays, we've got much better computing power. We've got data on property transactions. We've got data on the characteristics of different properties, you know, the size, number of bedrooms. If you go to Zoopla, for example, you'll see they predict the value of your property. Our report is based on effectively doing that as well, trying to look at the transactions, the property prices in an area, link them to the characteristics of the properties, and then predict a value for every property in the country. The government could consider using the computerized statistical approaches to reduce the cost of revaluing, and actually probably, for many properties, make it more accurate than the old way of driving down the street. Where it might be more difficult and might like, still need to do some more physical and sort of, you know, expert evaluations are the very most expensive properties or the most unusual properties. So when we were looking at this in our own modelling, we found it hard to sort of like value the country mansions or some of the most expensive properties in inner London or some of the very unusual properties, houseboats. So there might still need to be some physical evaluations, but the cost can probably be brought down quite a lot by using computers, using IT, and using statistics.
Okay. To close off, you touched on the fact that this government has quite a substantial majority in Parliament. Bearing in mind they've got a lot of, well, they've got a substantial mandate to kind of get things done, as they like to keep saying. What are you both hoping to see from government on this matter over the term of this Parliament?
I mean, from my point of view on this, what we'd like to see is it part of a much longer term funding certainty for local government. It's one of the elements, it's a really important element, but there are other issues about long-term funding that need to be answered, and as part of this, if it can't really be taken in isolation. And that links to my second point, the sort of payment and the way the funding is going to go for things like adult social care. If council tax is going to have to pay for that, we have to understand and accept that that will be an increasing demand going forward and a more expensive demand. And I would like to see this government certainly use their mandate to look at and to address cross-party with a long-term solution, something that does start to impact and address the tension that we see between this government's sort of devolution agenda, which is giving the power much more locally, and the contrast in their sort of central control around council tax with things like the referendum and very specific issues over discounts and approaches that they allow local authorities to take.
And how about you, David?
So I think kind of one of the key things is that what government is doing on public services, things like social care, children's services, housing, and what's doing on the local government finance system are consistent. I think there's a risk that you could see government sort of like putting more and more kind of conditions and standards and requirements on councils when it comes to the services, but a kind of more localised funding system. And you have central control, but localised funding, there can be problems arising where the funding doesn't line up with what the government's trying to get things to do. Mm. So thinking about the system as a whole and how it aligns between finances and policies is vitally important. I think the government needs to think about if it needs to find more money for local government, which I think our research last year suggested there is a looming funding gap, even if council taxes to go up 3-4% a year, it won't be enough. Is that going to be via more local taxation? Things like a local income tax? Or is it going to be via central government grants? Kind of continued top-ups to things like the Better Care Fund. But I think council tax is still a really important part of the system. As you've been saying, it's kind of more than 50% of councils' revenues now for things other than schools, about a third of revenues overall. It's about 3% of people's incomes on average. We've let it get out of touch with economic reality. So I think what the government should be doing is putting in place a system not only to revalue and reform it in the not too distant future, but also a system to do that on a regular basis so we never get into the situation again that it's 30 years out of date. And other countries have systems that update every year, so large parts of America, Canada, much of Europe. And indeed, there's still one place in England where we have domestic rates which are updated every year. I wonder if Jo knows where this is.
I don't actually.
Something called the Crown Estates Payments Commission. It's a local authority, a very small local authority, that manages some areas around Regent's Park, Carlton Terrace, near Buckingham Palace.
Right.
They levy domestic rates, which they get valued every year, as a simple proportion of value. Not only can it be done elsewhere in the world, it can be done in England. I'd be looking for the government to go and talk to the guys at the Crown Estates Payments Commission and find out what to do here.
Excellent note to leave it on. So thank you both for joining us on the episode today, and we hope to welcome you both back soon.
You've been listening to Sit for Speaks, and great to have David back on the show. That's about all we've got time for this month, so thank you to all of our speakers and to you, our listeners. We hope you're all keeping safe and healthy, and we'll see you next time. Goodbye.